75 years ago this week, in Washington, D.C., the representatives of 12 European and North American states came together to sign the North Atlantic Treaty. Many of today's issues about burden sharing, about the credibility of deterrence, about sort of the European versus the transatlantic dimension of the alliance, all of those challenges and issues today are as old as the alliance itself, and they were evident as early as the 1950s.
Hey, welcome to another episode of the Modern War Institute podcast. I'm John Ambo, editorial director at MWI, and I'm joined today by Seth Johnston to look back at the 75-year history of NATO. Seth is a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, and much of his military career has been spent in positions where he has worked closely with NATO partners. He also has extensive experience studying the alliance. In fact, he wrote a book about it called How NATO Adapts, Strategy and Organization in the Atlantic Alliance Since 1950. Now, NATO looks very different today than it did when it was founded, and the geopolitical, strategic, and military landscapes are also very different. But as you'll hear, the alliance's history is marked by some pretty remarkable continuity. That means an appreciation of its history offers a really useful framework to understand the challenges and opportunities that NATO faces today and that await it tomorrow. Before we get to the discussion, a couple notes. First, if you're not yet subscribed to the MWI podcast, you can find it on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Seth Johnston. Seth, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here with you at West Point and MWI once again.
So this week marks the 75th anniversary of the founding of NATO, which I think is an opportune time to sort of reflect on that history, history of what I think is undeniably an extraordinarily enduring and successful military alliance. You've actually written a book about it. It's called How NATO Adapts. I know that it has been a major part of your PhD research at Oxford. It's been part of your teaching career. You taught formerly at West Point in the Social Sciences Department. You're an adjunct professor at Georgetown and a visiting professor at Heidelberg University in Germany. It's also been a major part of your military career. You are currently a foreign area officer with a regional focus on Europe. And what I find interesting is that for much of your Army career, the Army has sort of been institutionally focused on the Middle East, places like Afghanistan, you know, the post 9/11 wars, the global counterterrorism mission, counterinsurgency and stability operations. And yet, despite that, you sort of retain this interest in Europe. So I wonder if we can kind of start, if you can kind of explain what drew your attention to the issue of NATO and the challenges and opportunities that that it faces.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And I agree. I mean, it's amazing to think that 75 years ago this week, in Washington, D.C., the representatives of 12 European and North American states came together to sign the North Atlantic Treaty. It was a revolution in the foreign policy of the United States, and it was a historic juncture in Europe that gave Europeans the confidence of having security to embark on what today has become the European Union, and really underwrote all these decades of peace in Europe and enormous prosperity that has been so beneficial to people on both sides of the Atlantic. I'll tell you what drew me personally into the study of NATO, but also into the Army and professional service of working with our European allies in Europe. And it happened when I was a West Point cadet. During the NATO summit in 2002, which was going to be in Prague in the Czech Republic, that was going to be the first time that NATO held a summit in one of the Eastern European countries that had been a member of the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War. And that was also a historic summit because a lot of countries are going to be joining the alliance, and that announcement was made at the summit. And to make that point symbolic, two West Point cadets were able to go. I went. I'm not sure how I got so lucky. But the other person that was chosen to go was my classmate, who was a exchange for the, or not an exchange cadet, but he was there for the whole 4 years. But he was a citizen of Lithuania. And Lithuania was one of the countries that was going to be joining NATO at the announcement at that summit. And so for the remarks that the president of the United States was going to give at this historic NATO summit, they had a West Point cadet from Lithuania introduce the president of the United States. And after the U.S. president spoke, the heads of government of some of the new member states spoke, and they talked about what it meant for the security of their countries, but also for the values of the liberal, democratic, Western community of nations that they felt like they had been invited to join and were joining. I knew I was a witness to history at that time, but that the work of the alliance continued to be important. And it was something that as a military officer and as a scholar that I wanted to be a part of.
Well, what a cool experience, really. You know, since that opportunity 22 years ago, you've done a variety of things, I think, that have given you different points of view on NATO. As an Army officer, as I mentioned, you're a foreign area officer focused on Europe. You commanded a multinational NATO task force in Afghanistan. But then on the flip side, as a scholar, you know, you have your book and your PhD. How have those experiences sort of combined to shape your point of view and your perspective and the way that you sort of conceptualize NATO and the challenges and opportunities that that it has?
I think I gained an appreciation, honestly, for the West Point model of officer training from that experience at the NATO summit, but also from everything that I did as a soldier and a scholar after that. I think I learned that to be effective as an Army officer, I needed to have the knowledge, the perspective of the history of these terrible conflicts of the 20th century that motivated countries in Europe and North America to embark on this revolutionary alliance. I needed to understand the politics, the culture, the foreign languages of this complex international environment that is NATO. It's a military alliance, but it's also an international organization. It's a very complex and dynamic place to try to work. And so the scholarship enabled me to be a better Army officer. But also being an Army officer gave me perspective, I think, on the theory and scholarship into the alliance as well. So being a soldier made me a better scholar of the alliance as well. I think I was fortunate enough to see it not only at the political and sort of headquarters and big conceptual level, but also on the ground. In places like Afghanistan, where I had the privilege of commanding a multinational NATO task force, and also here in Europe, where I've worked on some of the big plans and other transformative efforts that the alliance has undertaken recently since Russia's aggression of Ukraine.
You know, if you just compare what the world looked like in 1949 to what it looks like today, it's obviously very, very different. The alliance itself also looks very different, but I'm curious, you know, in your opinion, how much has it actually changed? How much has it evolved? You know, how recognizable would it be today to the 12 signatories to the North Atlantic Treaty?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned that what the scene must have looked like on April 4th, 1949, with 12 Western European and North American states signing this treaty. If you think about the late 1940s in 12 countries, and then fast forward to today, when NATO has 32 members, more than twice as many members, some of those members, used to be on the other side of the Cold War, or were even part of different countries at the time, part of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Empire. You might think that after all this time and such a transformation in the membership of the alliance, so many changes in international society and life, that we would be talking about two completely different alliances. I disagree. what's remarkable to me is not so much the way that NATO has changed and that the world has changed, but rather how consistent NATO has been at staying true to its core values and purposes after all this time. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty actually does a great job of articulating what these enduring purposes are. The treaty is a short document, and it starts with one paragraph that describes the values of the members that the alliance is meant to try to uphold. And then it commits the allies to doing a few difficult but simple to articulate things, like invest in their capacity individually and collectively to defend themselves, to consult with one another politically about issues related to security and defense, and in the famous Article 5, in the worst case scenario, to commit to defending one another, to consider an act of aggression against any one member to be an attack against all members. Things have changed a lot. NATO has changed a lot. The world has changed a lot. But the values and the core aims and purposes of the alliance have remained remarkably consistent over all these years.
Your book, again, is called How NATO Adapts, and it uses a framework that you call critical junctures to sort of illustrate alliance change, so to speak. I'd like to jump to one of those, and it was the West German question in the early 1950s. West Germany obviously was not an original member of the alliance, but in just a few years, you know, discussions surrounding its potential membership became one of those critical junctures. I wonder if you can kind of describe that.
Yeah. The early 1950s case is a great case for trying to understand not only what NATO is about, but how it has wrestled with the difficult challenges of actually trying to achieve these core aims. Many of the issues in the alliance today that you hear about in the news, and that will certainly be a big part of the debate at the Washington summit in DC this year for the 75th anniversary. Many of today's issues about burden sharing, about the credibility of deterrence, about sort of the European versus the transatlantic dimension of the alliance, all of those challenges and issues today are as old as the alliance itself, and they were evident as early as the 1950s. One way of getting after this question is to use this sort of cliched saying about NATO's purposes that's sometimes attributed to NATO's first Secretary General, Lord Ismay, who said that NATO was created in Europe to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. And in the 1950s, you see all of that. The biggest thing that happened in the 1950s was, in my opinion, kind of a rebalancing of those three purposes in terms of the hierarchy of threats to the alliance, away from a West European fear of Germany and towards a new Cold War era fear of Russia. When the North Atlantic Treaty was signed in 1949, it was the third alliance treaty concluded in as many years. There was a Treaty of Dunkirk in 1947 that was explicitly anti-German. This is an alliance among West European states that was explicitly anti-German. Yeah, this is only 2 years after World War II, of course. Then in 1948, the next year, there was a Brussels Treaty, again among Western European countries, that was still anti-German, just less explicitly so. And then 1949, the following year, you have the North Atlantic Treaty, which doesn't mention any adversaries by name. But in the thinking of that time, you have to consider, you know, only 3, 4, 5 years after World War II, the most destructive conflict of all time, of course, Western European countries were concerned about their neighbors. The 1940 campaign of World War II was the third time in 70 years that Germany had invaded France. And in the 7+ decades of NATO, there has been no great power war among those Western European states. It's a credit to the alliance that it was able to participate in helping to break that cycle. But as much as Western European countries and everyone who had been involved in World War II remembered those lessons, were concerned about what the future role of Germany was going to be in the international order, as the Cold War got underway, it became clear that substantial resources were going to be needed for the what we would now call the strategic competition between East and West in the Cold War. And one way or the other, Germany was going to be a theater of competition in that Cold War. And German power was going to be needed for that struggle. And so you had this incredible turn of events where fewer than 10 years after World War II, the members of NATO, the Western European countries and the United States and Canada that had been Germany's enemy in that most destructive conflict of all time, became treaty allies of West Germany. And West Germany was rearmed, incorporated into the Western alliance, and became a significant theater of the Cold War.
You know, I think that's significant for a couple of reasons. You know, I recently read this book called Project Europe by Kieran Klaus Patel that traces the post-war processes of European integration. And it highlights a lot of the arguments made by advocates of such integration, but also that in many cases it ran up against a number of challenges. Chief among them was often mistrust between sovereign states in Europe, particularly French mistrust of Germany, which is probably pretty natural given what you just said. You know, 1940 was the third time in 70 years that Germany had invaded France. And so I think the fact that the West German question was in fact resolved and resolved fairly quickly in the 1950s sort of shows the strength of the alliance and its foundational underpinnings in the treaty. I also think there's a pragmatic issue at play here, and the other reason that this is significant, you know, the Cold War context emerged pretty quickly, and that was going to require a lot of resources. Germany has long been an economic powerhouse, an industrial powerhouse in Europe, and so I think, you know, its entry into the alliance reflected a sort of pragmatic and sober appreciation of reality that I think is important to acknowledge. So I want to shift gears. We've talked a little bit about membership. What about burden sharing, which is obviously a major feature of discussions about NATO today? But I'm curious how quickly, you know, was burden sharing also an issue from the beginning, from NATO's formation?
Yeah, it absolutely was. Burden sharing is one of the oldest and most contentious issues in the alliance historically. But you're also 100% correct that it remains at the top level of importance in the discussion about among the allies today. The first real crisis, if you want to call it, the first real big moment where burden sharing became a contentious issue among the allies was in NATO's Lisbon summit of 1952, only three years after the treaty had been concluded. When the treaty was concluded, there was a provision in the treaty to create a permanent standing consultative body, what we now call the North Atlantic Council. But there was no requirement in the treaty to create what became the International Organization of NATO, this structure with a permanent international staff and secretariat. And there certainly also was not a treaty requirement or even the foreseen likelihood in 1949 that there would be a permanent peacetime multinational military organization, which is a feature of NATO that's entirely unique. There is no other alliance or international organization that has something like the NATO command structure, the standing multinational military structure that exists in peacetime. Allies decided in 1950, only 1 year after the treaty had been concluded, that they needed to create a peacetime multinational military force in order to prepare for the real possibility of a conventional war in Europe, because a conventional war had broken out in Korea. And the thinking was, well, I guess it turns out that war, even the potential for war involving great powers armed with nuclear weapons, is possible. But it would not be, and therefore preparations need to be made for large conventional forces that could stand up to that. So that was in 1950, 1 year after the treaty had been concluded, the thinking in NATO was already moving in that direction. But then, of course, the question was, well, who's going to pay for large military forces in the alliance? It's only 5 years after World War II. Europe economically, socially, in many other ways, is still really devastated from the conflict. The Allies agreed in 1952 to create large conventional forces, and the Europeans were meant to try to adhere to some pretty significant, they were called the Lisbon Force Goals. But within a year or two, it became clear that European countries were really going to struggle to meet those goals. That was one of the driving forces behind trying to bring Germany into the alliance. It was also one of the driving forces behind a move in U.S. strategy and a similar move in NATO strategy towards a reliance on nuclear weapons in the 1950s in a strategic approach or doctrine known as massive retaliation. So these burden sharing issues were big. They're big today. They were big in the 1950s. They led to huge changes, like the creation of the multinational peacetime military structure, like changes in strategy involving a reliance or lack thereof on nuclear weapons. And burden sharing helped drive early considerations on membership, notably the decision to bring Germany, the former World War II enemy, into the Western alliance. So it is the enduring point of intra-alliance politics. It was then, and it remains today.
You know, today, I think when we talk about burden sharing, we talk about 2% spending targets, right? This has become sort of the frame of reference for all discussions on the subject of burden sharing within NATO. Obviously, the 2% of GDP expenditure was not in the treaty. It's been around for a while, but it kind of most notably became a thing really when participants at the 2014 Wales Summit explicitly sort of committed to it. Can you talk about how it became that dominant frame of reference for discussions about burden sharing?
On the current debate about burden sharing and this so-called 2% issue that's often talked about. And by the way, what people mean when they talk about the 2% issue in burden sharing in NATO is that all NATO allies have agreed that a guideline of investment and spending on their own national defense should be at least 2% of gross domestic product. You are completely correct that this guideline in NATO has been around for decades, but it was notably endorsed at the level of heads of state and government. In other words, that all the presidents and prime ministers, the heads of state and government of all the NATO allies agreed at that level in 2014 that was going to be their guideline. The reason that this issue really came up, or the reason that we talk about 2% now, is because there was a desire to have some sort of explicit benchmark for how to measure the somewhat vague language in the treaty that just says that countries agree in the treaty to invest in their capacity, both individually as a country, but also collectively as allies, to resist armed attack. That language is put almost as simply as I just said it. They agree to invest in their capacity to resist armed attack. Well, how much is enough? That's where we came up with this crude but simple way of describing inputs or defense spending. The trouble is that that inputs or just spending on defense is not a great way of measuring the true capabilities or the outputs that national militaries or that the alliance would need in order to meet its strategic objectives or to implement its plans. And this has been one of the big changes that NATO has been working on the last few years. As much as there's been a lot of discussion politically and reporting in the media about the 2% issue of inputs, my view is that the more important story going on in NATO has been, both in the past and more recently, what's going on within the organization of the alliance in order to transmit the inputs or the capabilities that nations bring to the alliance into a military or other capability that can serve the alliance's political decisions. So as much as there's been a focus on inputs, it's really what the alliance has in terms of and what any nation has in terms of capabilities that really matters.
So I want to ask about another subject that comes up really all the time, I think, in discussions about NATO, at least military discussions, and that is interoperability. Was that also an issue in 1949, or was it sort of, you know, taken for granted because, you know, many of the signatories had just spent years operating in a large-scale fashion together during World War II? And if it was an issue, how did NATO sort of approach it in the early years?
Sure. On interoperability, the alliance was fortunate when it made this decision to create the multinational peacetime military structure. It was fortunate that many of the same people who had been involved in the coordination of the Allied military operations in World War II were still around. Most notably, of course, was Dwight Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander during World War II, and also the first Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. And by the way, when Eisenhower, after World War II, but before he ran for president, when Eisenhower became the first Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, there was no Secretary General of the Alliance at that time. So he really was the institutional embodiment of the Alliance at that time. And his personal credibility from his wartime experience and the skills that he had developed as a soldier, as a leader and a general, but also as effectively a politically aware and diplomatic figure who understood not only how to lead in a military environment, but also how to operate in a political and diplomatic environment. The personal credibility and skills that Dwight Eisenhower brought to the alliance in those early years was essential in setting the NATO military organization and to a great degree the NATO's political organization onto the path that it's been on. So close was the mental pattern of NATO's military headquarters to what had existed in World War II that the names of the headquarters themselves are even pretty similar. Today, NATO's top military headquarters is called SHAPE, the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. The World War II equivalent was SHAFE, the Supreme Headquarters for Allied Forces in Europe. So you can tell that quite a bit of knowledge and experience was ported over. A related figure also was Field Marshal Montgomery from the UK, who had been the top military figure in the military organization created by the Brussels Treaty of 1948. And Montgomery became first Deputy Supreme Allied Commander to Eisenhower. So he brought not only another body of institutional knowledge from multinational command during World War II, but also through participation in nascent peacetime multinational military activity in the Brussels Treaty Organization. Finally, then, to assume a role similar to the one that he personally had during World War II, working with, but under Eisenhower as Supreme Allied Commander. So I've talked about this mostly in terms of command organization. We could talk about logistics and doctrine and all the rest of it, but the short answer is that we can see that interoperability and the question of military organization among the Allies was a big issue right from the early days in the 1950s, but it benefited from being able to capture the wartime experience of World War II.
You know, listeners who follow news and current events in Europe know that there's a pretty active and ongoing discussion about, I guess, European strategic autonomy, about the strategic wisdom of putting all of, you know, Europe's defense eggs in a single basket, in this case NATO, a basket that is heavily reliant on an enduring U.S. commitment. That's a rational discussion to be having, but I'm curious how long that's been going on. Is that also something that traces its origins to the early years of the alliance?
Yeah. So the current debate about strategic autonomy or European strategic autonomy echoes very well a theme that has been evident in the whole history of the transatlantic alliance, that there is maybe not so much a tension, but at least a certain balancing or openness to solutions to new security problems in transatlantic relations or maybe within NATO that are, on the one hand, maybe more distinctively European. In other words, the solutions to addressing whatever the new challenge is, you know, ought those solutions be more distinctively European, or ought the solutions to the new problems or new challenges to security, ought they be more transatlantic? And this is true of the current debate about European strategic autonomy, but it was also once again true right from the very early years of the alliance. And since we've been talking about the 1950s case of how some of these current issues have echoes throughout the history of NATO, you know, maybe we'll talk again about the 1950s, because that was also where you saw, in this time where NATO is confronting a new challenge, the challenge brought about through the example of the Korean War in 1950, the realization that there needed to be peacetime preparations for conflict. And we talked about how this drove a lot of the thinking about the decision to welcome Germany into the alliance and to create large conventional forces. Well, ultimately, all this was done through NATO, but the proposal to do all that through NATO in 1950s was not the only proposal on the table. In fact, there was a distinctively European approach to trying to address all those same problems in the early 1950s. And this was the idea to create what was called a European Defense Community, the EDC. And this was a French-led proposal in 1950 to create really what amounted to a common European army by bringing together the military forces of European countries in the same supranational style that the coal and steel industries were integrated in European countries, and then that later provided the model for what we now have in the European Union. The European Defense Community idea was a serious proposal that got real traction. There was a treaty for the European Defense Community that was signed. There was a protocol to the North Atlantic Treaty for how the European Defense Community, which was composed of NATO member countries from Europe, of how that was going to fit with the NATO treaty obligations. And all of this planning and movement towards the European Defense Community went on for 3 years. It was only in 1953, 3 years after the original French proposal for the EDC, in sort of an ironic turn of historical fate, that the French National Assembly actually rejected the whole thing. And so at the last minute, all of this planning had to be sort of reoriented, and that's how we came about with the solution that that Germany was going to join NATO, and both the UK and the US were going to station substantial permanent conventional forces in Europe and Germany and elsewhere. But it might not have worked out that way. There were serious non-NATO alternatives to how to deal with those problems in the early 1950s. And the non-transatlantic, the non-NATO alternatives were distinctively European. So the idea that there's either a tension or a theme of the weighing of distinctively European versus transatlantic solutions to European security problems is a consistent theme in NATO history. What I might also add, though, is that the way that particular case in the 1950s ended, which was that the European proposal didn't really work out to full fruition, is also pretty consistent with the historical record. Often, even after a period of serious consideration of a European or a distinctively European or European only solution, often an element of transatlanticism or NATO involvement in the resolution of the problem is how those issues are resolved. And it goes back to those original purposes of NATO, one of which was to keep America in Europe with all of the resources that it brings, but also the reassurance and the tradition of the reassurance that politics among European countries are not going to get to the level of discord that they did during the 20th century, but also over time an expectation and a tradition of American leadership that has come to be expected.
So we talked a bit about the Cold War context that characterized much of NATO's history. A few decades ago, the Cold War ends. NATO is involved in a number of operations during the 90s, particularly in the Balkans, policing no-fly zones, peacekeeping operations. Then 9/11 happens. The day after 9/11, on September 12th, 2001, Article 5 is invoked. I'm curious what you think that says about the alliance, given that the context that dominated so much of its history had ended a decade prior. And yet, the alliance made this, the NATO members made this momentous commitment so quickly.
You make a great point about the NATO treaty and the fact that the most commonly cited Article 5, the collective defense provision, an attack on one is an attack on all. You make an important point about how that article has only been invoked one time. And in a way that I don't think anybody in 1949 would have expected. And that was Article 5 was invoked after 9/11, when all of the allies honored their treaty obligation in responding to an attack on the United States. This is one reason why it's important to underline just how much throughout these 75 years, the United States has seen it in its interest, its own interest, to have been a member of the alliance, and that was proven by this alliance decision after 9/11, when European countries honored that treaty commitment. And as you pointed out, NATO allies stayed involved in the conflict in Afghanistan for 2 decades after that. Now, setting aside the question about the strategy in Afghanistan and the way that it ultimately panned out, it's a remarkable thing that there was that level of political cohesion and multinational military interoperability sustained in a theater so far away from NATO's core area for such a long time, more than 20 years. It is a remarkable credit to what NATO as an institution is able to do and provide for its members, that it was the institution that allies chose to organize their military and even political activities in Afghanistan for such a long time.
So I think that offers a good segue for us to kind of zoom out a little bit. 9/11, it was definitely this inflection point, a critical juncture, maybe in the vernacular that you use in your analytical framework in your book. Our discussion so far has kind of highlighted these various phases, these periods of NATO's history. You had the formative years, you had the Cold War, you had the post-Cold War 90s, then you had the post 9/11 era, and now we're in this current period of strategic competition, which has seen, you know, the return of conventional warfare to Europe, large-scale conventional warfare. As you look at those various periods, how has NATO kind of, you know, this is the subject of your book, right? How NATO adapts. How has NATO actually adapted to the requirements of each of those?
Sure. As we talked about earlier, the Washington Treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty, is short. And it's elegant, and it has served the Allies well. It articulates the purposes, it articulates the main responsibilities and benefits that countries derive from being a member of the alliance. The principal ways that NATO adapts to the emerging or differing security challenges of each of its ages, you know, as it's gone through these 75 years, the two principal things that NATO adapts are its organization, which is more of an internal matter, and its strategy, which is how does it organize all of the means and other resources, political, military, and otherwise of the Allies in order to accomplish or implement its decisions. The some of the changes in organization that we've talked about were really pretty revolutionary. Yeah, the idea between 1949 and 1950 to create a standing peacetime multinational military force. The idea later in the 1950s to build out the international organization, to create an international organization out of a military alliance, which is not often what happens in military alliances. So those were organizational, internal, institutional kinds of changes. Strategy is the other way that NATO has adapted to the different challenges. We talked about NATO's strategic approach in the early 1950s of relying very heavily on nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence in the massive retaliation approach. NATO's strategy during most of the rest of the Cold War was known as flexible response, and envisioned a range of mostly military options with deliberate escalatory steps from conventional to nuclear. After the Cold War, NATO's strategy moved a little bit out of the purely military domain and into more of a political and public domain. After the Cold War, NATO's strategic concepts started to be published publicly and made available unclassified to the public. NATO military strategy continues to be formulated internally, tends still to be classified. But NATO's strategic concept for the last more than 30 years have been made public. And this embodies another important point about NATO that is also an enduring feature that you see in the treaty, which is that even though NATO is known as a military alliance and has a standing political deliberative decision-making structure, there is an article in the treaty, Article 2, which is not looked at very often, but Article 2 commits the allies to considering a range of other political and non-military activities that are in the service of NATO's values and its goals of peace and security, but that use non-military means. This article has historically been a little bit underplayed, but some of the big critical junctures in NATO's history have featured a reorientation towards this non-military aspect of NATO. There was the so-called Committee of the Three Wise Men during the early days to look at non-military cooperation in NATO. More famously, in the mid-1960s, the so-called Harmel Report on the future tasks of the alliance. The Harmel Report articulated a strategic approach for NATO in which dialogue and political engagement would be elevated to an equal footing with defense and deterrence for ways that the alliance would conduct itself during the Cold War. And you've seen evolutions of this kind of thinking in subsequent strategic and organizational adaptations of the alliance as well. You're seeing it today, where, just as you mentioned, NATO in many ways is getting back to basics with conventional and nuclear military planning and organization, but at the same time also grappling with big changes in the structure of international politics, emerging technologies, and other very 21st century modern challenges.
Well, I think we will wrap up there. Again, I want to thank you for joining me. It really is, I think, a pretty momentous occasion, the 75th anniversary. I've personally enjoyed the sort of look back at NATO's history, and I hope listeners will as well. So thank you.
Thanks very much, John. It's great to be with you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing before you go. If you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.